In 2004, an IBM executive named Jean-Paul Nerriere announced the emergence of a new lingua franca. He called the language Globish. According to Nerriere, this radically simplified version of English has become the world's common tongue. Robert McCrum takes up the case in his new book, Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. McCrum told me that the more you look, Globish is everywhere.
I became increasingly aware, as time went on, of this global reach that it had and the way in which the ideas that it was expressing were being picked up all over the world by non-native speakers of English. And my eureka moment, if you want, came in about 2005 in September. I don't know whether you can recall those protests against the cartoons that appeared in the Danish magazine of the Prophet Muhammad.
Oh, well, of course.
There was a tremendous outcry all across the Muslim world, and a lot of people got killed. There were riots in Afghanistan, Nigeria, all over the place. And there was one particular demonstration which really caught my eye and caught my imagination. There was a demonstration of fundamentalists in London outside the Danish embassy in Park Lane. And these guys, who were all from Saudi Arabia and the Far East and all over the place, marched down Park Lane, and they marched outside the embassy, and they carried slogans like "Behead the infidel," and the one that caught my attention was "Down with free speech."
Down with free speech.
Down with free speech, which seemed to me a sort of surreal collision of Alice in Wonderland with the jihad. So here they are. Here are these Muslim fundamentalists in London using English to denounce the freedom which had allowed them to make the protest.
There have been arguments for years that English is the language people use to talk business around the world. But this is something more than that.
What I'm saying is it's as though the language is kind of encoded with ideas of freedom, ideas of liberty, the ideas of self-expression, the ideas of asserting oneself, of explaining things in a simple form against an oppressive dominant force. And this goes back, I say, to the Norman Conquest and before that. So I'm saying that the language is somehow, as I say, encoded with these ideas, so that the language carries with it, as it were, a way of life or a way of looking at the world. Now, that could be said to be sort of faintly imperialistic. I'm saying that it is now being adopted by people all over the world with no sense of its British or its American history.
Let's talk a little bit about the language now to start this conversation, though, because I think you have to start with the way in which English has spread over the entire world.
One definition of Globish is it's the use of English by non-native English speakers. And it was Monsieur Jean-Paul Nerriere who it was his discovery. He was a Frenchman, he was an IBM executive, and he was posted to Japan in 1995. And he made this observation. He observed that in meetings between Japanese and Koreans, or Japanese and Filipino, or whoever it was, the non-native speakers did much better in conversation in English with other non-native speakers than with English or American speakers, who are using nuance, allusion, idiom. And so he said that what he called a decaffeinated version of English, a simplified, stripped-down version, is much more useful internationally than the language that you and I are using, which is, you know, laden with all kinds of associations and idioms and styles, which would not mean much in somewhere like Japan.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that he went on to say, at least I believe that he went on to say, that in some ways the spread of English has preserved other languages.
I think what it is now, it is the default position. If you're a German or a Pole or a Ukrainian or a Georgian or an Iranian, you know, whatever you are, and you need to communicate with somebody else, a Punjabi or a Japanese, the language that you will turn to, if neither of you can communicate in some other language, will be English. So in that sense, the mother tongues are not being threatened. It's like an alternative. It's like a parallel universe to which people can turn when they need to make a communication internationally. And so Globish is this parallel universe, which is a kind of English.
Which raises the question, of course, how is this happening? How are people learning English, or Globish, if you will, in places where it isn't the first language?
Well, in somewhere like China, it's being taught by rote in these extraordinary open-air, these sort of mass language schools where 10,000 people repeat English. It's an extraordinary scene. It's called Crazy English. And they learn English by rote, by repeating after the teacher. I mean, that's one extreme example. Then, obviously, in other places like Mexico or something, it'll be taught in primary schools. So it's being picked up in all kinds of different ways. And, of course, in somewhere like India, it's being taught by language schools, language classes. People are learning it, turning to it, as this way out of non-communication.
Why do you think it is that English was so ripe to be developed into Globish?
Well, mainly for one extraordinary historical reason, which was that one empire, let's say the British Empire, which was, as you know, covered a quarter of the globe in the 19th century, was followed by another empire, that's to say the Pax Americana, the American Empire, which used essentially the same language and the same set of cultural references. I mean, this has never happened before. When Greece gave way to Rome, you moved from Greek to Latin, which was, I mean, similar but not just very different. In this case, the decline of Britain was followed by the rise of the US during the First and Second World Wars, and that is the essential reason why the globe is anglicised.
Mm. And saying anglicised is interesting too. You start the history of English and its journey to Globish with the Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain. Their footprints are all over it, aren't they?
Yeah, in any sentence that we're using, you cannot get away from what I call the building blocks. You know, the words like is, the, man, house, all these simple words, simple monosyllabic words, are almost all Anglo-Saxon. They are at the core of the way we speak.
And you begin to build the core of the language that we use, too, and the ideas behind it with all of the great English writers, Shakespeare and Samuel Johnson. And the things that they thought and believed, I guess, traveled with the language as it moved.
Yeah, so the language is like a kind of virus, it's a kind of benign virus which carries, first of all, meaning, but also association. And the associations are the associations to Lincoln, Mark Twain, Shakespeare, you've mentioned, Johnson, yes. All these writers who've gone around the world are associated with this little linguistic virus.
You would think that the objection to the empire and the objection to American military might would have pushed people away from English.
Well, that is the extraordinary thing, and that is why I say, how is it that it was not only survived, but was also adopted? So, that for example, in India, during the protests against the British Raj, the opposition, Indian nationalist opposition, chose to use English as a way of expressing their opposition to the imperial. Now, why is that? It's completely counterintuitive. And I'm saying it's to do with the, as I say, the association of libertarian ideas which the language carries.
How was the language itself then shaped by the imperialism that carried it abroad?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting question. It was shaped by warfare, shaped by advertising and trade. Somebody once said that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. and in some senses, English arrived abroad at the point of a musket or a cannon or a bayonet. We cannot overlook the fact that the benefit that we derive today begins with bloodshed and mayhem and all kinds of oppression. There's no question of denying that. That's the fact of it.
And so you have the language carrying ideas both ways. You talked about the force of popular culture. Certainly things like Coca-Cola and jeans have traveled around the world, and I suppose in that sense the language came with them. How much weight do you think the language of Western popular culture carries?
I think you have to look quite closely at individual examples. I mean, a film like Precious is a good example. A film like Slumdog Millionaire is a very good example. And that's a real case study, because that was a novel written by an Indian diplomat, Vikram Swarup, in Indian English, which was then turned into a script by a British scriptwriter and then filmed by a Scot in Mumbai with a Bollywood cast. So God knows what the English is, but anyway, it's certainly not the English that you are using. But there's an example of the process I'm describing, this kind of tremendous mishmash of styles, ideas, vocabulary, grammar, all mashed together into this glorious mixture.
You know, we're talking about the glories of English, and certainly it is a rich and varied language. Are there losses to English that come from the development of Globish?
That's a very interesting question. I think probably not, because I think at the level at which you and I are communicating now in international radio communication, nothing has been lost by, we aren't simplifying this discussion for any Globish purposes. On the whole, the benefit to the language comes from, I mean, Walt Whitman talked about change bubbling up from below, and I think the thing about English that's characteristic of it, it tends to borrow from the mass culture and tends not to be affected. I'm sure there are purists who will say that the English is being corrupted, and the people have always said this. People have always said it's been corrupted by change. But personally, I don't see that. People have worried about these corruptions. Shakespeare worried about them. Shakespeare's contemporaries worried about them. Jonathan Swift worried about them. Johnson worried about them. There were Americans like John Adams who was concerned about these things. But on the whole, it's like a compost. It goes on getting richer and richer and stranger. And more nutritious, too.
Robert McCrum is associate editor at The Observer and the author of Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language.